Chorus of Wisconsin to your radio. This is a Perpetual Notion Machine for Thursday, February 15th, 2018. I'm your host, Will Cushman. Most of us have heard of the term biodiversity, but what does it actually mean in a scientific sense, and how do ecologists measure biodiversity and other ecosystem traits that can be kind of difficult to quantify? Tonight's guest does just that. Phil Townsend is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and leads the Townsend Lab on campus. Phil's research team specializes in studying and quantifying biodiversity and other ecosystem traits through remote sensing techniques. So that kind of begs the question, what are these remote sensing techniques and what do they measure? Tonight, we'll discuss these questions and also talk about a fun statewide project that Phil helps lead and you can participate in. It's called Snapshot Wisconsin. Phil, thanks for joining us and welcome to PNM.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I do want to start with kind of a what seems like a very basic question, but I imagine the answer can be a little complicated. I'm wondering if you could give us your understanding as a scientist and ecologist of what biodiversity means and tell us a little bit about the ways that scientists like you study and measure and quantify biodiversity and other ecosystem traits.
Sure enough. Well, an ecosystem is, if you can imagine a place on the ground, an ecosystem is all of the animals, plants, microbes, etc. that are within it. Biodiversity, then, a pretty straightforward way, would be the number of different organisms that are there, the different organism types that are there. So how many different plant species, how many different animal species, how many different microbes. So high biodiversity would be a lot of species. Low biodiversity would be a very small number of species. That's where it gets complicated, in that some locations may have a lot of species, but may have most of the species all be one species. Others may have an even distribution. So what we're interested in knowing is all of these different species that are there, as well as how they're distributed. Why are we interested in this? Well, different species perform different functions. If you think of birds, for example, there are species that may be ground nesters. There may be species that are at the top of the canopy. There may be species that eat insects. There may be species that eat fruits and things like that. And these all perform functions in an ecosystem. So you want to maximize your biodiversity within an ecosystem to be able to perform all these functions. And if you start losing biodiversity, you start losing some of the things that might be important to an ecosystem. And I should also say that in the context of climate change, biodiversity is pretty important as well, because it provides opportunities for new species to fill niches as the environment changes due to climate change. And if you have just a very small number of species, say, for example, a monoculture of trees, you don't have a lot of opportunity for new species to be able to perform those functions if the climate becomes unsustainable for the species that are there.
Right, right. So I want to talk a little bit about what you specifically do and some of the tools that you use, including drones,
yeah.
I understand, and spectroradiometers,
yes.
And other
so
tools.
The traditional method for computing biodiversity is boots-on-the-ground ecology. And in fact, I love boots-on-the-ground ecology. That's kind of what I started doing. You go to a site and you count everything that's there. And this can actually be really hard because you have ephemeral plants and animals and things like that. As well, you can't do that everywhere.
Yeah. And I was like, what does counting everything that's there like practically involve?
Yeah. Well, counting everything that's there are getting people who can identify the species. First of all.
Okay, sure.
And then if you're looking at microbes and all of the organisms that are in the soils, you have to take samples back to the lab and people have to go through and sort through the soils. They have to sort through the litter. People who are entomologists have to know all of the insects. So to really actually understand all of this, you need a great deal of knowledge about taxonomy. So, but you can do that. In fact, in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, they have a large project that's been going on for a number of years to try and actually quantify all of the species among all taxonomic groups that occur there. And it's an unbelievably difficult task, especially somewhere that's as rich in diversity as the Smoky Mountains are.
Sure.
So what we want to do is actually find ways to couple those measurements that we can make on the ground with other measurements so we can make maps. I love maps. I love to see maps of where things are. And actually, that allows us to ask questions like, why are these animals here and these animals here? Or why do these plant species grow there? And if you haven't sampled it, but you can find another way to map it, then you have the benefit of being able to ask those questions.
Sure.
So we use remote sensing, and that's a lot of different things. The most obvious remote sensing that probably all of us see every day would be weather maps or Google Earth or Google Maps images, things like that. So there are satellites that NASA and other agencies and private companies put up that are imaging the Earth all of the time. But these images can also be collected from airplanes. The types of data that my group works with, there aren't satellites, at least not satellites for this type of research use, to collect the data. So we use airborne imagery. But you just mentioned drones as well. We can put these types of sensors and cameras on drones and fly over over ecosystems. Why would we use drones? Well, we can actually, if we're controlling the drone and collecting an image over an area that we're interested in, we can do that at the right time of the season that we might want to do. But, you know, things like trail cameras, which is what Snapshot Wisconsin uses, another sort of remote sensing. Nobody's out there actually tallying the animal. There's a camera that's out there that's triggered by motion when an animal walks by it. And that becomes a remote sensing measurement that we can then use and have information over a large number of areas. And just to kind of pitch the type of remote sensing that I do, in addition to the trail cam work, we do something that's called hyperspectral remote sensing, which measures lots and lots of different wavelengths. Most images that you would see, like weather images or Landsat images or things that are on Google Maps, have a few wavelengths that are measured that produce an image. Well, we can actually measure hundreds or even thousands of wavelengths. And think about what light does when it interacts with a plant. So light hits a leaf. Some of it reflects off the leaf, but some of it's absorbed by the leaf to conduct photosynthesis. Some of that light that's absorbed by the leaf gets dissipated by the leaf as heat. Some is actually readmitted, and a lot of it is used for photosynthesis. The chemical makeup of the leaf, the different chemical bonds, molecular bonds that are in the leaf, are different between different species. And so that light that hits the leaf is going to absorb differently and reflect differently based on what the chemistry of the leaves are. So we can use these methods to actually measure the chemistry of the leaves. That's another form of biodiversity. It's not species diversity like taxonomy, like this is a red oak, this is a white oak, this is a black oak. It's actually a taxonomy of the differences in the chemistry of the leaves, and the chemistry defines the function and can explain a lot that's going on in an ecosystem.
Right. So what are some of the questions related to that chemistry? Like, what are you wanting to figure out or study or observe there?
Well, the easiest thing, our planet depends on plants for photosynthesis. It's the primary productivity on the plant. So at the very basic level, we want to understand photosynthesis. We want to be able to model photosynthesis. We want to be able to understand how plant uptake of carbon dioxide will change under different types of climate scenarios. And I hope everybody out there knows this. Plants and trees, and particularly forests, are the one thing that's really mitigating climate change right now, that a lot of the excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that we know is being taken up by forests. So understanding how trees will do this under scenarios of climate change is really helpful. So that's sort of the first level, is that if we can map all of this stuff, we know how photosynthesis varies on the landscape. Not every location takes up carbon dioxide and uses nutrients the same way. But the next thing is that we can use this to understand vegetation response to disease and insects. And these have lots of important ramifications. On the one hand, in agricultural systems, it's something that farmers need to know both economically and in terms of thinking about how they do pesticide, herbicide, those types of treatments.
Right.
In natural systems, it's important to understand how forests or grasslands or any other type of ecosystem is going to respond to these types of disturbances. So we can actually map chemistry that's associated with defenses and responses of plants. And again, if we're trying to understand how ecosystems are changing and how they can maintain their value, whether it be the aesthetic values, you know, we love hiking, or value as a crop, as timber. Everybody needs toilet paper. So, you know, there's always going to be a certain amount of logging of forests because of that. People want to know this type of information, be able to understand how to manage the ecosystems. And we really do have to think about managing our ecosystems in the context of climate change, because these ecosystems, they're important just on their own for biodiversity's sake, but they're important for maintaining water quality, quality of life, air quality, lots of things that people maybe don't think about right away, but we use this information to help us understand.
Sure, sure. Where are you doing this remote sensing? Are your projects mostly based in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I would say that they're mostly based in Wisconsin. And the upper Midwest, maybe I would say half of my work is based there.
Sure.
And then the other half of it is based everywhere. So the National Science Foundation has this thing called NEON, which is the National Ecological Observatory Network, where they're basically, they put up these concentrated observation networks in all of the major eco regions of the U.S. So Alaska, California, Rocky Mountains, Southeast, et cetera. And we have a project where we're using a lot of these technologies to see if we can develop methods that work everywhere. So one of the things is that we can work in Wisconsin, but does the method and the analysis that we do in Wisconsin apply to somewhere in Alabama or somewhere in Washington State and so forth? And so we're using all of these NEON sites. I do a lot of work with NASA. The type of technologies that we use, NASA wants to eventually get into space. And so they've actually been collecting imagery in a lot of different places. They had a concentrated campaign in California that coincided with the major drought that California had that ended last year. And so we did some work in California associated with that. They just finished flying in India. And I actually just got back from 3.5 weeks of field work in India, which
cool.
was quite an experience. But it's important that we do these in all types of ecosystems. So India has this very unique tropical forest. They're called tropical deciduous, tropical wet, dry forests. So they have a distinct dry season and a monsoon season. Trees lose their leaves during the dry season, as opposed to losing their leaves like we do during the cold season. And so the functioning of those ecosystems is quite a bit different from our ecosystem. So it's important for us to be able to collect data in those types of places as well.
Sure, sure. So what are some differences in geography that could make one remote sensing methodology useful in one area, one region, and maybe not so useful in another region?
Well, remote sensing is extremely hard to do in cloudy areas.
Oh, okay, sure.
And so that's another reason why people like using drones, is because you can be well beneath the clouds and you can have something looking up and something looking down and be able to correct for that. But if you're an airplane or a satellite, you've got clouds between you and the earth and not be able to do that. So places that have very sunny environments during the times that it's important to make measurements, make a big difference. So it's actually really hard to do remote sensing work using visual imagery in places like the Amazon because of the cloud cover. So they do use visual imagery, but they use a lot of other types of imagery like with radar, for example, which can penetrate through the clouds and give you, they don't give you images that look the way you and I would expect an image to look because it's a radar image, but it actually is able to give you some useful information by sending the signals through the clouds and back up.
Sure. What type of useful information does something like radar give you?
Oh man, radar is really cool. So radar, wavelengths of radar. So imagine energy moves in waves.
Yeah.
So light that we see with our eyes is 400 to 700 nanometers. So very, very, very small wavelengths. Radar wavelengths are more on the order of 2 to 25 centimeters. Okay, so up to about a foot. And so this radar wave is going through, is sent out by the satellite, goes down, and then it interacts with the surface. Depending upon the size of what it's interacting with, if the size of that item, of that material that it hits, like say a tree or a leaf on a tree, is larger than the size of the radar wave, so a big leaf tree, the radar wave is going to interact with the leaf and then reflect back. If the radar wave is longer than the leaf size, it will go through and then interact with the surface and bounce back from the surface. So people use radar to measure the total biomass, total carbon stock, and stuff like that. The other cool thing about radar is it interacts differently with the ground if the ground is soil versus litter versus standing water. So you can actually get information about what's beneath a canopy from radar, which you wouldn't be able to do using standard imagery.
Sure, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So what research are you currently doing, or what have, like, maybe something you've wrapped up that you are particularly excited about?
Well, I'm definitely excited about Snapshot Wisconsin, and I hope the people out there listening get excited about it and Google it and go and look things up about it. It's actually a little bit different from what the things that I've just been describing. The objective, though, is to quantify the diversity of animals in Wisconsin, or the distribution of animals in Wisconsin. I'm not a wildlife ecologist, so it's really funny that I became the lead investigator on this project.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit how Snapshot Wisconsin came about?
Yeah, so about 5 years ago, NASA started to get really interested in citizen science and crowdsourcing, with the understanding that there aren't enough resources out there for everybody to collect all of the ground truth type data that needed to be collected. So they put out this request for proposals for people to develop programs that would use NASA imagery for mapping and then would use crowdsourcing or citizen science to collect the ground data to validate this. And the one requirement that NASA had was that you had to partner with an agency. You had to have a target user group who really needed data that they couldn't get, that we could find a way to do this. So I went to one of my colleagues, Ben Zuckerberg, who is a wildlife ecologist in my department here. And I said, this sounds perfect for you. And his response back to me, he was an assistant professor at that time. So he didn't have tenure, and he hadn't worked with NASA previous to that. He said, okay, I'll do this, but only if you keep working on it. And so at the same time, the Wisconsin DNR had been under a lot of criticism. Some of you may remember the Deer Czar report had been under a lot of criticism that it wasn't managing the deer herds in Wisconsin very well. And there was a lot of, some of it was people saying, I don't see deer in my normal hunting ground. But some of it was some legitimate criticisms that we really didn't have. The data that we were using to quantify deer distribution across the state had some real limitations. And so the DNR had been considering a statewide trail cam project that would get us past this. So the way that data for monitoring deer and actually a lot of other game species in particular are collected is essentially from hunter data as well as spot data collected by DNR scientists. And so as you can imagine, there are places where people hunt. There are places where there's more hunting and more reporting.
Sure.
And so it was not really a very consistent type of data set. The idea was that if we could put trail cams out in every county, basically in every nine square mile block in the state, of which there are about 6,000 blocks that size, if we could have a trail cam in every single one of those places, we would then have a distributed network of data that would be collected exactly the same way. And not only could we quantify deer, but we could also quantify other animals of interest, whether it be bobcats or coyotes or turkeys, you know, any animal that would be captured in a trail cam. To go beyond that, not everywhere in the state has public land where these cameras would go. And so this would be, the majority of the state would require these cameras to be on private land. And sure. So this is where the citizen science comes in. We asked for volunteers, people who are interested in contributing to this, to volunteer their property within these different blocks as a place to put the cameras in. So the DNR will provide a camera to a user and train the user how to use it and how to upload the data to the DNR website. And that becomes our data collection. And there's another aspect of citizen science, too. So far in the project, we've generated 18 million clicks, 18 million shots of animals.
Oh, like so, individual photos.
Yes, yeah. 18 million individual
yeah,
photos.
That's a lot of data.
So how are we going to classify them? The algorithms that are out there for automated detection of different animal types aren't of sufficient quality.
Sure.
And so that's where the Snapshot Wisconsin Zooniverse comes in, which...
You say Zooniverse?
Zooniverse. So okay. Zooniverse is out of the Adler Planetarium in Chicago, and it's a crowdsourcing website, but it's where Snapshot Wisconsin is hosted. So the photos get uploaded to this website, and it's Snapshot Wisconsin. .org is where you would get to it, but it's a site that's managed by Zooniverse, who does Snapshot Serengeti and some other ones that are fairly well known. But don't do Snapshot Serengeti. Do Snapshot Wisconsin. people then can go on, people from all over the world can then go on and classify our photos for us. So we've got citizen scientists who put the cameras out and who collect the data off the cards and upload them to the website. And then we've got this other website, the Snapshot Wisconsin website, where people from all over the world can go and say, oh, that's a deer, that's a deer, that's a deer, that's a deer. Oh, that's look, a turkey. So that's how we generate our data. And actually, we have seasons of Snapshot Wisconsin because we upload large batches to the Snapshot Wisconsin website. We're right now in season 7, so we haven't classified all the photos, so people should go on. It's a great way to kind of zone out and look at some cool pictures. So we then take the information. So then we have, right now we have over 1,000 cameras distributed across the state. And so what we have is in time and space, we have all these observations of where different species of animals are. And those are individual locations where a camera are. What we really want to do is make a map.
Right.
So that's where NASA comes in. NASA is collecting imagery, useful imagery all over the state. Information about land cover, information about species type, information about temperature, information about snow cover. There's the night lights maps. So they take imagery. The satellites go around the Earth during the day and they go around at night. And there's this night lights imagery, which can actually tell you where human populations are. And there's some animals that don't mind being around people and other animals that avoid people. So we can bring all of these data together with all of the data from the cameras, and we can start making predictions of where the animals are, what the density of the animals are, and so forth.
Sure, sure.
And so that's where the remote sensing, the imagery comes in. It's what allows us to make statewide maps.
Gotcha. And I understand that the program is still expanding, like into new counties, correct?
Yeah. Yep. So there, I think, not quite sure what the number of counties is, 28 to 30 counties.
Okay.
There's just a bandwidth issue with bringing on new counties. But, you know, within the next few years, we hope to be in all counties. You can go to the DNR snapshot page and see which counties are open. We've just opened up a bunch of new counties, and people can go on and volunteer to put a camera on your property.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that there are a lot of deer, and I can attest to our listeners, I've been on Snapshot Wisconsin and spent like a few hours IDing animals. It's really fun. And actually like a useful way to kind of not waste your time.
You're doing the good of the people. You're collecting data for science.
Exactly. You're doing a public service.
And for people who love wildlife and the outdoors in Wisconsin, it's the ultimate goal is to help the DNR better manage and better understand wildlife and animal populations in the state.
Right. Have there been any like really surprising animal, or what's the most interesting, or are you aware of anything that's like surprising or interesting, an animal showing up in a game camera somewhere?
I would say that there are more bobcats than I would have expected, although our graduate student John Clare, who studied bobcats for his master's, would probably say he could have told me that. But actually, the photos that are the most interesting to me are the ones that are the behavioral photos.
Okay.
So we haven't caught any cougars or anything like that on photos yet. But looking at what you see, so we have one series of photos where where some coyotes tracked down and caught a fox, actually. And it's kind of neat to see these behaviors. Seeing the behaviors of deer who are very vigilant and very concerned about what's around them can be kind of fun. And bears are just a hoot.
Yeah.
Because I know prior to coming to the University of Wisconsin in 2005, I worked at a research institute in the Appalachian Mountains, and we did a lot of work out in the mountains, and there were a lot of bears there. And bears are curious about everything. Anything that's not natural material, so something that's got, you know, some rubber or some polyurethane or anything like that, bears become interested in it and they can smell it. And so, you know, we've just got these pictures of bears just sitting in front of the camera. They see the camera, they know it's something that doesn't belong there, they don't know what to make of it, and they go and they just plop themselves down in front of it.
Right.
And so there are lots of just really funny pictures of different behaviors by animals.
Cool. And can you, we're about out of time, but can you remind listeners one more time where they can go to participate?
Yeah, so snapshotwisconsin.org is where you should go. And you can also just Google Snapshot, because there's a DNR Snapshot Wisconsin webpage, which will have information about how you can volunteer if you're in one of the target counties that are open. Even the counties that have been open for a while, there are still areas in the state where we need people to volunteer.
Awesome. And anywhere where people can go to look at some cool maps that you've generated?
Yeah, the DNR website is one of the places where you can see some of the maps. And this is a DNR project. We helped get it started with NASA, but we want DNR to be able to sustain it going quite a ways into the future. And not just yet, but very shortly, we will start having maps on the Zooniverse, the crowdsourcing website, as well.
Awesome.
We've just started making maps. It actually takes a few years of collecting data before you have enough data to make those maps.
Patience.
Yeah.
Patience is a virtue.
Yeah.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thanks a lot, Phil Townsend. Really appreciate you coming in tonight.
This was great talking.
A really fun conversation. And we want to thank everyone who listened tonight, as always. And we want to remind everyone that we are always looking for new volunteers. So if you're interested in talking to smart people about cool science, or maybe just want to learn how to engineer on a soundboard, please get in touch at scienceonwort@gmail.com. That's scienceonwort@gmail.com. This has been another edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine, brought to you by the Madison Science Radio Collective. Thanks again to our guest, Phil Townsend. Our show tonight was engineered by Case Wheatley, and I'm your host and producer of tonight's show, Will Cushman.